I have worked in two apparently unrelated subfields, philosophy of science and the history of philosophy. Within each of these subfields, moreover, I have pursued diverse interests. In philosophy of science, for example, I have pursued both technical philosophy of physics and classical themes in general philosophy of science, explanation and confirmation. That's pretty close to the beginning of your talk. I have been deeply influenced by thinkers from the logical empiricist tradition, such as Rudolf Carnap and Karl Hempel, but also very substantially by Thomas Kuhn, often taken to be responsible for the widely rumored demise of that tradition. In the historical subfield, I have pursued both the history of 20th century analytic philosophy and Kant scholarship, so much so in the case of Kant that various friends and colleagues have assumed that I was now lost in the weeds bequeathed to us by the sage of Königsberg and no longer working in philosophy of science at all. Against the background of both Kant scholarship and the history of analytic philosophy, finally, I was even led in a parting of the ways, Carnap, Kissler, and Heidegger, 2000, to consider the common roots of the analytic and continental traditions as they arose concurrently at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. One may wonder, therefore, whether there is any coherence in the diverse themes I have taken up throughout my career. Now, I could shorten this by simply saying no, but that would be too easy. So I am extremely grateful to the Dewey Lecture Committee for giving me the opportunity to reflect on this question. I shall try to show that and how the personal perspective to which I refer in my title does make coherent sense, such that philosophy, science, and history are thereby combined in a single whole. My systematic engagement with philosophy began during my undergraduate years at Queens College of the City University of New York in the years 1965 to 69. So now you begin to have an idea of how old I am. The philosophy department there was large, diverse, and inspirational. I had come to Queens intending to major in music, but I had earlier done some philosophical reading on my own in the existentialist approaches to theology and philosophy of the time, including philosophy of religion. Moreover, both my father, then a professor of English at Queens, and my mother had serious philosophical interests. Indeed, my mother finally completed her BA in philosophy at Queens after many years, at the same time that I did. At that time, I was totally mortified that we finished at the same time. Now I think it's wonderful. So I was already primed to have the philosophical spark fully awakened in me. My initial courses at Queens revolved around the more humanistic philosophical orientation of my earlier reading. But my interest soon turned towards symbolic logic, taught in the philosophy department, and mathematical logic, taught by Elliot Mendelssohn in the mathematics department, both of which contributed to my rapidly growing interest in mathematics, physics, and the philosophy of science. A particularly consequential event occurred towards the end of my time at Queens when Karl Hempel came for a two-week stay. Hempel's first teaching job in the US was at Queens during the years 1939 to 48, after a Rockefeller Fellowship working with Carnap at Chicago. And he, Hempel, was now returning from Princeton for a visit. His warm kindness, great clarity of mind, and boundless enthusiasm made an overwhelming impression on me, and I resolved to apply to Princeton for graduate school. Fortunately for me, I was accepted, and my extended career in philosophy then began in earnest. The Princeton philosophy faculty was very strong in the years 1969 to 73, including such well-known senior philosophers, aside from Karl Hempel, as Paul Benacerraf, Donald Davidson, Gilbert Harman, David Lewis, Thomas Nagel, Richard Rorty, Dana Scott, Gregory Vlastos, and Margaret Wilson. Thomas Kuhn had recently arrived in 1964 in the context of a joint program in history and philosophy of science, although I did not get to know either him or his work well until later. Among the less senior faculty with whom I worked especially closely were Clark Gleamore and Hartree Field. Gleamore, in particular, was doing exciting new work in the philosophy of physics, pursuing the approach to Newtonian physics and Einsteinian relativity theory as four-dimensional space-time theories, both all of them, an approach that had recently been rediscovered and made known to a philosophical audience by Howard Stein in 1967, closely followed by John Ehrman in 1970. Although I had come to Princeton with Carl Hempel especially in mind, envisioning a dissertation on scientific explanation, I ended up writing my dissertation under Gleemore, with Ehrman as my second reader and Hempel a member of the examination committee. Dissertation on the new approach to a scientifically informed philosophy of space and time. A substantially revised and expanded version of the dissertation was published by Princeton University Press in 1983 under the title Foundations of Space-Time Theories, Relativistic Physics and the Philosophy of Science. When I arrived at Princeton, I learned that all graduate students were expected to take an oral exam at the end of their first semester on a quote-unquote great man from the history of philosophy. You heard that right. Princeton, originally founded to further the progress of Southern gentlemen towards a career in diplomacy, had only very recently become even coeducational. I had already been inspired during my undergraduate years by P.F. Strawson's The Bounds of Sense, 1966, which considered anew the Kantian philosophy, together with the history of modern philosophy generally, from the perspective of 20th century analytic philosophy, descriptive metaphysics, as Strawson called it. I studied the Critique of Pure Reason with deep admiration, but little real understanding, and I resolved to study Kant more seriously in the future. So when I arrived at Princeton, I chose Kant for my great man exam. Jonathan Bennett, who co-contributed along with Strawson to the analytical rebirth of Kant studies and the study of modern philosophy generally, was visiting Princeton at that time, and accordingly he served on my committee for the oral exam. Fortunately, once again, I passed the exam, and Bennett seemed pleased enough with our discussion. This increased my confidence, or should I say hope, that I might be able to do something useful in Kant scholarship someday. Yet there were not many opportunities for serious Kant study at Princeton during these years. Ledger Wood, the Kant scholar at the time, was just retiring during my same first year. So my further study of Kant began rather circuitously after I left Princeton as I was revising my dissertation for publication. That's why it's circuitous. These revisions included three new chapters, an introductory chapter on relativity and logical positivism, together with two final chapters on relationalism and conventionalism, respectively. In between were these more technical things about Newtonian physics, special relativity, and general relativity. I discovered, as a number of scholars had already discovered, that during its reception of Einstein's theories of relativity, logical positivism was by no means a radical empiricist movement in the tradition of Hume, Mach, or A.J. Ayer. On the contrary, it was equally influenced by Kantian and neo-Kantian themes, emphasizing the a priori logico-mathematical structures with which we frame our sense experience in modern mathematical physics and theoretical knowledge more generally. Hans Reichenbach's first book, The Theory of Relativity and A Priori Knowledge, published in 1920, is clear and explicit about this, and similar views were also expressed at the time by both Carnap and, to a lesser extent, Moritz Schlick. It was this experience in particular which first made it possible for me to view logical positivism, I prefer logical empiricism, as continuous with Kantian and neo-Kantian philosophy, and at the same time seriously to entertain the idea that Kant's own philosophy of science, crafted with Newtonian physics specifically in mind, was not best viewed as a dead appendage of the critical system, which should therefore be amputated and forgotten. I shall return to this point shortly. Immediately after I left Princeton, I took up an assistant professorship at Harvard. It was an unusual version of such a position, as the department had then instituted a 3-year assistant professorship with no possibility of renewal or tenure. These positions became aptly known as folding chairs, and I had the somewhat dubious honor of holding the first. Nevertheless, the position had the considerable benefits of a good postdoctoral fellowship, a reduced teaching load, no anxieties about promotion or tenure, and first-rate faculty, graduate students, and undergraduates with whom to interact. These folding chairs eventually faded away, due to worries about continuity in graduate education. So they no longer exist. For me, and also Harvard began giving tenure to people. For me, in any case, the position was perfect for the time, and I formed lasting philosophical friendships then with both faculty and graduate students. By the way, are you hearing me okay? Because I see I'm fading in and out here. I would like to mention in the first place John Rawls, who had a central and very serious interest in Kant, as well as, more surprisingly, a deep knowledge of modern mathematical physics. At my job interview, attended by Burton, Drevin, Rawls, and W.V. Quine, I think maybe Nelson Goodman too, although I don't remember, at least he didn't say anything. All of those people were there at the dissertation, at the interview. It became evident that only Rawls, of all of them, had a clear understanding of my report on my Princeton dissertation. Incredible. I would like also to mention Hilary Putnam, with whom I shared many illuminating discussions of the foundations of modern physics, especially quantum mechanics. And finally, I would like to mention W.V. Quine again, who was the perfect embodiment of a responsible senior colleague. I was working on a criticism of Quine's doctrine of the indeterminacy of translation at the time. Everybody was doing that. I showed it to Quine and received an excellent, open-minded written response. I only realized that Quine had been right all along much later, well after my paper had been published. With the help of my Stanford colleague, Dagfinn Follestal, who had been a student at Quine's himself at Harvard much earlier. I became close friends with Warren Goldfarb, who was then finishing a term as a junior fellow and a dissertation on the history of logic under Burton Drebin. I was invited to attend an extracurricular seminar led by Drebin, informally called the Drebinar, attended by his dissertation students and, in time, the folding chairs. Here we discussed Drebin's favorite philosophical figures, Frege, Russell, Wittgenstein, Carnap, and Quine, and in general what we now call the history of analytic philosophy. My participation in the Drebinar and friendship with Goldfarb provided the initial impetus for my burgeoning study of this subject in connection with the revisions of my dissertation mentioned above. Among the other participants in these ongoing discussions over the years were Peter Hilton, who completed a dissertation at Harvard on Bertrand Russell in 1978, and Thomas Ricketts, who had taken up a folding chair of his own in 1976. I am deeply indebted to Goldfarb and Drebin, together with Ricketts and Hilton, for helping me to acquire my first proper education in the subject. After my folding chair at Harvard predictably folded in 1975, I moved to the University of Pennsylvania, which was then embarked on rebuilding the department with new faculty, which included in those years such promising philosophers as Scott Weinstein, a mathematical logician from Rockefeller, and Tom Ricketts again, after his own stint as a folding chair at Harvard ended in 1979. And that's where we all met, Ricketts, myself, and Alan. My transition from Harvard to Penn was largely occupied with the final revisions of my dissertation on space-time theories. And a number of papers from the Princeton-Harvard years had either already been recently published or were now appearing. These included two co-authored papers on the logic of quantum mechanics, one with Gleimor in 1972, the other with Putnam in 1978, a paper on explanation and scientific understanding, 1974, and a paper on truth and confirmation, 1979. I remained at Penn until 1982, after becoming a tenured associate professor in 1978. A very consequential shift in philosophical orientation took place in 1980, after my book on space-time theories was now safely in press. It was not then clear what my next philosophical project would be, or whether and when such a project would emerge. I had learned of Gerd Buchdahl's book, Metaphysics and the Philosophy of Science, from 1969, from some of my friends from Harvard days. Buchdahl's book is an historical examination of the development of what we now call philosophy of science in the modern period. His subtitle is The Classical Origins, Descartes to Kant. And it concludes with a massive chapter devoted to Kant, approximately one-third of the volume's almost 700 pages, culminating with the development of Kant's philosophy of science up through the Critique of Pure Reason, 1781, 87, first and second editions, and Metaphysical Foundations of Natural Science, 1786. Reading Buchdahl's book in 1980 was an illuminating and exciting experience, for it showed me how, in the modern period from Descartes to Kant, philosophy of mathematics and natural science were closely entangled with the more general themes in metaphysics and epistemology, typically emphasized in philosophy departments. Moreover, this interweaving of mathematics and natural science with modern metaphysics and epistemology, on Buchdahl's account, culminated in the transcendental philosophy of Kant. So you might imagine my eyes getting bigger and bigger at this point. So it is not too much to say from this point of view that one cannot properly understand Kant's philosophy while also leaving aside his mathematical and scientific views. Yet it can be overwhelmingly tempting to do precisely that, for Kant's views appear antiquated from the perspective of our current science. We can no longer believe that Euclidean geometry is the only correct one, nor that Newtonian mechanics has a similarly privileged status. Thus, since Kant appears to be philosophically committed to both of these views, it seems that we have no choice but to leave his mathematical and scientific views entirely aside if we want to find and preserve what is still living in Kant. What I discovered, stimulated by Buchdahl's book, was that there is a more interesting and productive way to juxtapose our current scientific and mathematical knowledge with Kant's. Rather than using our current knowledge to disparage and dismiss our philosophical ancestors, we could use it to shed light on how they, at the time, had found perfectly viable solutions to then extant problems. The example that initially inspired me was Buchdahl's discussion of Kant's commitment to constructive spatiotemporal intuition, which is first emphasized in Kant's pre-critical essay, Attempt to Introduce the Concept of Negative Magnitudes into Philosophy, 1764. Here Kant argues for a principal distinction between real and logical opposition. While the addition of two motions oppositely directed and equal, plus A and minus A, yield an equilibrium situation, a state of rest, the conjunction of two predicates, one the negation of the other, A and not A, yields a logical impossibility and thus nothing at all. Kant concludes that logic alone, conceptual containment, is insufficient to capture the real necessary connections found in nature. And this 1764 essay was thus one of the many factors in Kant's awakening, first inspired by Hume from a dogmatic, that is, rationalist slumber. This essay on negative magnitudes thereby represents one of Kant's important initial steps towards the synthetic a priori. Going beyond Buchdahl's discussion, I addressed the central example of the synthetic a priori from the critical period, Kant's theory of construction in pure spatiotemporal intuition applied to the science of geometry. Geometry for Kant was, of course, Euclidean, and in particular, the geometry appearing in Euclid's Elements. The issue was not so much whether space was Euclidean or non-Euclidean, a question that did not really arise at the time. The issue was rather to understand the way in which the reasoning in Euclid's Elements proceeded, and in particular, the relationship between Euclid's geometrical reasoning in the Elements and traditional logical reasoning. Having read the classical discussions of Kant's conception of intuition in mathematics by Jaakko Hintikka and Charles Parsons, I found a way to develop a more general account building on both of their insights. Thus, to use a more general example not employed by Hintikka, we can construct a straight line segment between two given points by postulate one, rotate the segment around either endpoint, constructing two circles by postulate three, and then construct a vertical bisector of the initial segment by drawing a further line segment between the resulting intersections of the two circles, proposition 10, and so on. This "and so on" was now the crux of the matter, and here I drew upon Charles Parsons' insight into the importance of iterated applications of the successor function in arithmetic. But the same insight also applies in geometry, where we have three initial operations, connecting two points by a line segment, postulate one, extending such a line segment by another segment, postulate two, and again rotating a segment in a plane to construct a circle, postulate three, rather than a single initial operation, the successor function. The deeper point in both cases is that we thereby have the means of representing infinity, at least potential infinity, throughout mathematics generally. With traditional syllogistic logic alone, by contrast, no infinite structure, even a potentially infinite structure, can be represented. One simply cannot say in any monadic language with a finite number of predicates that there are more than a fixed finite number of objects in the domain. An anachronistic way to put it, but it's still true. I have begun working on these ideas while still at Penn, with help from both Scott Weinstein, the logician from Rockefeller, and Tom Ricketts, the philosopher. I further developed them at the University of Illinois at Chicago, to which I had moved in 1982, with additional substantial help from William Tate. Bill Tate was now at the University of Chicago in Hyde Park, where I had first settled when moving to Chicago in order to learn more about Newton from Howard Stein. At issue now, however, is my work on Kant's theory of geometry, which was published in 1985 under the same title. For it was this work that first convinced me that I had a significant new way of approaching Kant's philosophy after all, an approach that could also then apply to the further development of scientific philosophy in such figures as Helmholtz, Mach, Poincaré, and Einstein, as well as continuing further to the 20th century logical empiricist scientific philosophers who were influenced by them. I felt that I had now found my place in the philosophical world with more interesting material to explore than could ever be exhausted in one lifetime. So true. After finishing my work on Kant's philosophy of geometry, my next project was to consider his philosophy of physical science, represented in particular in the metaphysical foundations of natural science. Here, however, I could no longer follow Buchtal. For on Buchtal's interpretation, there is what he calls a looseness of fit between the critique of pure reason and metaphysical foundations, such that specifically Newtonian physics is merely illustrative of Kant's more general conception of cognition, rather than essential to it. This idea, from my perspective, betrayed the same traditional failure of nerve whereby we take care not to saddle Kant with now superseded scientific views. We should do precisely that. And it's for precisely this reason that I endeavored, on the contrary, to put all my emphasis on Kant's understanding of Newton in his own, Kant's own, late 18th century historical context. Because he really understood what was going on there, and that's the point. As Jess suggested, I had originally accepted a position in Chicago in order to learn more about Newton from Howard Stein, whose seminal paper entitled Newtonian Space-Time had appeared in 1967. This paper had given the initial impetus to the four-dimensional space-time approach within recent philosophy of science more generally, shared by Clark Gleamore, John Ehrman, and David Malamud, whose dissertation, that is Malamud's, like mine, was directed by both Clark and John. But what most interested me now was that Stein's paper not only clearly elucidates the conceptual structure of Newton's theory within a contemporary mathematical formulation, it also illuminates Newton's original argument in the Principia within the historical context of his, Newton's, predecessors and contemporaries, especially Leibniz and Huygens. One of the most controversial questions surrounding the Principia then, and perhaps still now, was the distinction between absolute and relative, true and merely apparent motions, which Newton famously discusses in the scolium to his initial definitions in the Principia. But Newton fully articulates this distinction, as he states at the very end of the scolium, only in the final book, book three of the Principia, where he derives the law of universal gravitation and describes the resulting system of the world, as he puts it. For it is only at this stage that Newton is able to demonstrate that the true center of motions in the solar system is always very close to the center of the sun, although the latter, the sun, is nonetheless truly moving, albeit slightly, relative to the true center, which in turn is nothing other than the center of gravity, center of mass, of the solar system itself. Of course, the sun has most of the mass, but not all of it. But Howard Stein did not discuss Kant's metaphysical foundations. My task, therefore, was to understand whether, and if so, how, Stein's sophisticated approach to Newton could be applied to Kant's understanding of Newton as well. I was greatly helped in my initial efforts as a visitor at the University of Western Ontario, where I presented an 8-week series of seminars. Since the invitation had come from Robert Butts, the founder of the program in History and Philosophy of Science at Western, and an important Kant scholar in his own right, together with my good friend William Demopoulos, whom I had first met at a conference on quantum logic there at Western in 1974, I eagerly accepted the invitation to visit 10 years later in 1984. I presented a course on the metaphysical foundations and made considerable progress, resulting in my first paper on this topic entitled The Metaphysical Foundations of Newtonian Science, appearing in 1986 in a volume edited by Robert Butts commemorating the 200th anniversary of Kant's treatise. Since the topic is very difficult and Kant's treatise is extraordinarily compressed, here in translation is the whole thing, 100 pages. His treatise is extraordinarily compressed, this really was only the beginning, and I continued intensively to work on this project throughout the following 30 years. Fortunately, I survived that. It is appropriate to add at this point that my first public discussion of the topic outside of Western Ontario was a Newton conference at Yale in 1987. Robert DeSalle was finishing up his doctoral work at Chicago under Howard Stein, who also spoke at the conference. And he, DeSalle, commented on my paper, Kant and Newton, Why Gravity is Essential to Matter. I had a long talk with DeSalle immediately before the conference began, and I found his comments extremely insightful. DeSalle, unlike Howard, was more than willing to discuss the metaphysical foundations in detail, precisely in relation to Newton. And it was this fact in particular that nourished and supported our lifelong philosophical partnership, that is myself and DeSalle. When the volume arising from the Yale conference was published in 1990, DeSalle had already moved to Western Ontario himself after finishing his PhD at Chicago in 1988. There he, DeSalle, also formed a philosophical partnership with Bill Demopoulos. Bill passed away in the spring of 2017 after a 10-year battle with lymphoma. DeSalle and I both miss him very much, but we are also celebrating the amazing philosophical work Bill produced during these years, really the best of his life, concluding with a new manuscript on theories, discussing the logical approach to scientific theories developed by Carnap, Jean Perrin's experimental defense of molecular reality, as he called it, together with the experimental perspective on quantum reality due to Niels Bohr. And this volume, we think, of Bill's on theories represents the culmination of his lifetime of work. I am now editing this volume for Harvard University Press with valuable help from DeSalle and others. My second book, Kant and the Exact Sciences, 1992, reprinted earlier papers on Kant's philosophy of physics and mathematics, together with new material on his so-called opus posthumum. I taught seminars on the metaphysical foundations in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at Indiana University, to which I had moved in 1994, and finally at Stanford, to which I had moved from Indiana in 2002. I worked my way through Kant's extremely challenging text of only 100 pages, as I said, writing and rewriting chapters throughout these years. I finally finished the book to my satisfaction, with invaluable help from the philosophical Newton scholar George E. Smith, and it appeared finally in 2013 as Kant's Construction of Nature, A Reading of the Metaphysical Foundations of Natural Science, my volume on this little book of some 600 pages. Kant's constructive philosophical account of the best physical science of his time was incommensurably more difficult than his analogously constructive account of Euclidean geometry. So I can't really begin to explain what my approach to the metaphysical foundations was or is, but if you want to look at this easily findable and relatively short book from 2004, which is a translation and edition of the Metaphysical Foundations, there's an introduction there which, at a suitable introductory level, says at least what I thought then in 2004 about the Metaphysical Foundations. During my years at the University of Illinois at Chicago, 1982 to 94, my efforts comprised more than my initial work on Kant and Newton. Anil Gupta, Penelope Maddy, and Mark Wilson all arrived during these years, and I formed lasting philosophical friendships with all of them. This little group was further enlarged by a visit from my already good friend Bill Demopoulos, who quickly formed friendships with the others. It was an exciting time for all of us, and we each expanded our philosophical horizons as a result. After moving to Chicago, publishing my dissertation, and pursuing my work in Kant's philosophy of mathematics and physics, the main expansion of perspective that I experienced concerned the history of analytic philosophy. You may forget about that by now. And in particular, the history of logical empiricism. I began reading the work of J. Alberto Coffa, an Argentinian philosopher focusing on the work of Carnap, both in logic and the foundations of mathematics and physics. I learned that Coffa had already been able to find a more sophisticated approach to Carnap and logical empiricism that was by no means radically empiricist in the traditional sense. Coffa had also moved to Indiana University, Bloomington, and I had eagerly looked forward to a conference there that he was co-organizing with Jeffrey Hellman in 1984, Hellman from the philosophy department. Unfortunately, however, Coffa unexpectedly passed away towards the end of that year after missing the conference due to urgent travel at the age of 49. This was a great loss for me and for our field. It was also a great personal loss for his former student, Graciela de Pieris, who had followed his advice to emigrate to the US for her PhD. She completed her doctorate in philosophy at Berkeley, as Coffa had earlier completed his at Pittsburgh, and she became a colleague of his at Indiana Bloomington during that same fateful year. By coincidence, she is here in red, a true Argentinian in dress. During that same fateful year, fortunately for me, however, Graciela attended the conference while Coffa was still alive and apparently well, although now back in Argentina. She and I began talking about Kant and Frege at the conference, finding that we had very much in common, together with just enough philosophical disagreements to make things interesting, both philosophically and personally. Graciela's philosophical, we have been philosophical partners and life partners ever since. Graciela's philosophical influence on me was already evident in my first serious paper on Carnap, Carnap's Aufbau Reconsidered, which was prepared for a memorial volume of Nuss dedicated to Coffa, appearing in 1987, edited by his wife, Linda Wessels, and colleague, Hector Neri Castaneda. My close connection to Indiana University and to the legacy of Alberto Coffa was further cemented in 1991, when his book, The Semantic Tradition from Kant to Carnap, semantic tradition, that's the key to it, to the Vienna Station, finally appeared with Linda Wessels as editor. I am both pleased and honored that Linda thanks me in her preface for my help. Due to the pioneering work of Alberto Coffa, the Harvard tradition originating with Drebin, continuing with Goldfarb, Ricketts, Hilton, and myself, and related traditions outside the US, the history of analytic philosophy, embracing logic, mathematics, and the philosophy of science, began to gather substantial momentum. We can trace its evolution in a sequence of volumes in Minnesota Studies in the Philosophy of Science. Volume 11, for example, concerns history and philosophy of modern mathematics and originates in a conference at the University of Minnesota in May 1985. The published version, appearing in 1988, includes contributions, among others, by Warren Goldfarb, Howard Stein, Philip Kitcher, and myself. The succeeding volume 12 of the series, appearing in 1989, was devoted to essays on Bertrand Russell's metaphysics and epistemology, including contributions by Warren Goldfarb, once again, Nino Cocchiarella, Herbert Hochberg, and others, including a co-authored paper by myself and Bill Demopoulos. Graciela de Pieris and I moved to Indiana in 1994, myself to the Department of History and Philosophy of Science, Graciela to the Philosophy Department. My first arrival there and Graciela's return, now as a tenured associate professor, were greatly facilitated by John Barwise, Michael Dunn, and Paul Eisenberg in the philosophy department. In the Department of History and Philosophy of Science, moreover, my arrival owed much to the historian of biology, Fred Churchill, then chair of the department, and the remaining senior philosopher, Noretta Kortka. I served as chair of the department in the years 1995-2000, of course, after being told I would never be asked to be the chair, but I couldn't say no at this point, during which we managed to replace the retiring historians of medieval and early modern science, Edward Grant and Richard Westfall, with two now very eminent historians still at Indiana, William Newman, medieval and early modern, and Domenico Bertoloni Melli, early modern science and medicine. Volume 16 of the Minnesota Studies, Origins of Logical Empiricism, a volume that Alan is familiar with, grew out of a workshop on this topic at the University of Minnesota in 1993. The year before we, that is Graciela and I, moved to Indiana. The volume first appeared in 1996. This volume represented the full maturation of the history of logical empiricism as a subfield, I say. Aside from an introduction and afterword by the editors, Alan Richardson and Ronald Geary, there were contributions by Peter Gallison, Nancy Cartwright, Richard Kreith, Warren Goldfarb, yet again, Don Howard, Thomas Oberdan, Alan Richardson, now with a paper on Carnap, Tom Ricketts, T.A. Reitman, Joya Turner, and Thomas Ubel. My own essay was entitled Overcoming Metaphysics, Carnap and Heidegger, and it was the first version of what later became the book, A Parting of the Ways. I was particularly indebted in this project, the Carnap-Heidegger project, to Thomas Ubel for calling my attention to the fact that Carnap had personally attended the famous Davos disputation between Heidegger and Ernst Cassirer in 1929. And, perhaps surprisingly, Carnap was particularly impressed by Heidegger, although not sympathetic with his views. Cassirer was then the most prominent representative of the Marburg School of Neo-Kantianism, founded by Hermann Cohen. And as such, Cassirer had already figured prominently in my previous work on the early logical empiricists, especially in connection with Carnap's Aufbau. So it was not as unexpected as it first appears that I would produce a volume like A Parting of the Ways. For the main theme of this volume was that the analytic and continental traditions had just reached an inflection point in the late 1920s, during which they emerged from a shared problematic concerning the fate of Kant and neo-Kantianism, an argument as it were, into a sharply partisan divide wherein they could no longer even understand one another. Graciela and I moved to Stanford in 2002. We found an exciting environment for Kant studies there, including Alan Wood, one of the co-editors, along with Paul Geyer, then at Penn, of the Cambridge edition of the works of Kant in translation, and also the less senior scholar Lanier Anderson, working on the origins of Kant's analytic synthetic distinction. I continued to offer my evolving seminars on the metaphysical foundations leading up to the publication of the final manuscript in 2013, greatly helped with respect to Newton's Principia by George Smith, who taught his famous Newton course at Stanford a number of times, attracting virtually all of our best students in the philosophy of physical science. Is Edwin Parker here? He just got his PhD with George Skyping in at the oral exam. He also is a Kant scholar. These lectures, as well as many other events, were supported by the Supies Center for the History and Philosophy of Science, which Patrick Supies had founded in 2004 with myself as director. Pat, as we like to call him, passed away in 2014, but I shall always be indebted to him for his faith in me and his sometimes challenging, but always steadfast, friendship. The run-up to our move to Stanford was especially important in my intellectual development, for it signaled a second consequential shift in philosophical orientation. The possibility of this move developed during a three-lecture, that is to Stanford, during a three-lecture series I presented as the 1999 Kant Lectures at Stanford under the title Dynamics of Reason. I aimed to disrupt the reigning consensus in favor of Quinean epistemological holism on behalf of a neo-Kantian and historical conception of relativized a priori principles. The argument I gave was itself historical, drawing from my earlier discussions of the background and development of logical empiricism from the 19th century scientific philosophy of Helmholtz, Mach, and Poincaré, through Einstein's philosophical perspective on his theories of relativity, both special and general. By the way, there is a volume of the Schilp series of important philosophers, living philosophers, and there is one on Einstein, which is called Philosopher Scientist. I think the only one distinguished that way. To the assimilation of these theories against the 19th century background by the early logical empiricists. I also appealed, crucially, to Thomas Kuhn's theory of scientific revolutions, which employs the transition from Newtonian to Einsteinian mechanics as a central example. This transition for Kuhn belongs to revolutionary, rather than what he calls normal science, because a change in such a fundamental part of physics as mechanics, although motivated by empirical considerations, cannot straightforwardly be confirmed by these considerations. For the laws of mechanics, as I would put it, first implicitly define or constitute the fundamental concepts of the theory, force, mass, motion, and interaction, without which there can be no empirical confirmation of particular empirical laws. This is especially clear in Newton's original mechanics, the case Kant was considering in the Metaphysical Foundations, of course, because Newton's three, what he calls axioms or laws of motion, inertia, F equals ma, action equals reaction, okay, he didn't say F equals ma, but I don't want it to take too long, which precedes even book one of the Principia, are then simply presupposed as axioms in Newton's argument for the law of universal gravitation in book three. This kind of distinction, in my view, between the constitutive and the empirical principles, between general constitutive principles and particular empirical laws, carries over into the case of Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, as formulated with Einstein's special theory of relativity, and Einstein's theory of gravitation, as formulated within his general theory. In the end, therefore, although Kuhn himself did not realize it at the time, and even took as his opponent what he called early logical positivism, that's a quote, it turns out that Kuhn's reaction to Einstein's relativistic revolution was largely consistent with the reactions of the early logical positivists. Indeed, Kuhn's structure of scientific revolutions first appeared in a volume of the International Encyclopedia of Unified Science, founded by Otto Neurath in 1962. Carnap, one of the two associate editors of the series, now living in Chicago, enthusiastically approved of Kuhn's book, and he took Kuhn's distinction between normal and revolutionary science to be closely aligned with his own distinction between internal and external questions relative to a particular conceptual, as he called it in his correspondence, later linguistic framework. The most important philosophical question now arising concerns how the idea of a relativized a priori in Reichenbach, Carnap, or Kuhn avoids falling into the trap, by no means clearly avoided by Kuhn, of taking the transition from one framework to another to be less than fully rational. In particular, if we take the language of the new framework to be non-intertranslatable with that of the old, as both Carnap and Kuhn did, then how are we even able to understand the new framework, much less make a rational decision to choose the new framework over the old? In my published 2001 Dynamics of Reason, another little book, so that means I have to write another big one, and subsequent works, I focused on the relationship of Newtonian gravitation theory and the Einsteinian alternative, namely general relativity. An especially salient difference is that, while the Newtonian framework uses Euclidean geometry, of course, the Einsteinian alternative employs the theory of general manifolds, first developed mathematically by Riemann in the mid-19th century. Since this theory did not even exist within pure mathematics in Newton's day, it appears that the Einsteinian alternative, representing the gravitational field in terms of a four-dimensional non-Euclidean manifold of variable curvature, involves an entirely novel logico-mathematical possibility. And even if we consider this alternative as now mathematically possible after Riemann, it is still not clear how it could be a physical, empirical, or what Kant calls a real, as opposed to merely logical possibility. Recall Kant's 1764 essay on negative magnitudes. At this point, still in Dynamics of Reason, I introduced Einstein's famous thought experience involving a rotating reference frame. A rotating reference frame is not an inertial frame, which has to be moving with constant speed in a straight line, in which all true accelerations in an inertial frame are due to genuine Newtonian forces. This kind of frame, a non-inertial frame, manifests, especially a centrifugally rotating one, manifests centrifugal accelerations due wholly to its motion, not to anything else. Moreover, just like gravitational accelerations, such motion-dependent accelerations are the same for all bodies regardless of their mass, regardless of their size or mass. Compare this to Galileo's experience with differently weighted balls dropped from the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Okay, he probably didn't do that, but it's a good idea. And that's an example, of course, of gravitational acceleration. But it seems like the centrifugal accelerations behave in the same way. According to Einstein's principle of equivalence, however, we should equate such gravitational accelerations with the analogous accelerations arising in a rotating or otherwise non-inertial frame. And if we consider a uniformly rotating frame within the context of special relativity, which theory was already well established at the time, it turns out by the Lorentz contraction that the ratio of the circumference to the diameter of a circle centered on the axis of rotation is not equal to pi, a sure indication that the geometry is not Euclidean. It seems to follow, therefore, that it is now also physically or empirically possible to represent the gravitational field by precisely this kind of geometry. It was not meant to be. I was satisfied with this solution for many years. After delving further into the relationship between Kant and Newton during my years at Stanford, however, I realized that it is not satisfactory, after all, precisely by Kantian lights. For in the critical period, Kant takes the real possibility of empirical concepts, as opposed to a priori concepts, mathematical and categorical, to be the same as their actuality, the fact that there are instances of the concept, the empirical concept, given in experience. Moreover, the concepts of force, mass, and true acceleration are definitely empirical for Kant, and true accelerations in particular must satisfy the principle of action equals reaction. That is, there are two bodies interacting with one another. But what we now call pseudo-forces, like centrifugal forces, are precisely such as not to satisfy this principle. There is a motion-dependent acceleration, but no corresponding massive source. What we need, I now concluded, is a real experiment rather than a thought experiment. And we must rather focus on the actually undertaken confirmatory tests of general relativity, such as, for example, the eclipse observations of 1919, very famous ones, which show that the gravitational deviation of starlight around the now eclipsed sun conforms to the Einsteinian rather than Newtonian prediction. There were two predictions, because in Newtonian physics, you can also get a prediction, but it's about half the deflection of the Einsteinian one. There can be black holes in Newtonian physics. There is a deeper and more general point at issue. Experience or empirical cognition for Kant requires two independent faculties, sensibility and understanding. As Kant famously says, thoughts without content are empty, intuitions without concepts are blind. Ho-hum, what does that mean? Or to put it another way, all concepts, whether pure or empirical, require what Kant calls schemata, whereby intellectual concepts are related in various ways to perceptual content in space and time. In the case of the empirical concepts of force, mass, and true acceleration, the most important examples of schemata involve the principle that the mass of a primary body in the solar system is proportional at a given distance to the acceleration toward this body of one of its satellites. For it is precisely this principle, allowing us to make the inference to the mass of the central body, which then enables Newton's demonstration that the center of motion of the solar system is just its center of mass. Yet the concept of mass, like those of force and acceleration, is a theoretical rather than observational concept. One cannot simply see or feel the quantity of mass of a body, especially one that is separated from us by astronomical distances. But one can precisely measure this quantity nonetheless in the manner indicated, an astronomical test, which in turn essentially involves perceptual procedures that can only be carried out in the realm of what Kant calls phenomenal experience. The Kantian conception of schematism, on my new view, should be preserved in any successor of Newtonian mechanics involving a fundamental theory of force, motion, and interaction, together with a concept of the matter, that is, what is doing the interacting, undergoing these interactions. All of these concepts, however abstract they may become in the purely mathematical part of our evolving mechanical theories, which become incredibly abstract, these must still be analogously related to perceptual measurement procedures in any genuinely empirical such theory. Kant's sharp distinction between understanding and sensibility, presupposed in his conception of the schematism, is therefore also preserved. His famous dictum concerning our need and recognition for both concepts and intuitions remains valid, not as a trivial remark about sensation versus conceptualization, but rather as a profound methodological insight into the practice and progress of fundamental physical theory since Newton. Thank you.